anyone out there, all I can really say, politely and in a sing-song voice, is blow my big bovine tiny dancer cock. Or you could just skip the whole thing. Your choice. Anyway, I finally reached the point where nothing in my closet fit other than a few socks, some hats, and a scarf. Ultimately, it might as well have been an entire other human's closet. Basically, I was drifting closer and closer to that point of no return, where people have to buy two seats on an airplane, and their families are forced to bury them in grand pianos, or cremate them into enough ashes to almost fill Charlie Sheen's ego. But come the fuck on. How many women do you know who are over 45 or over 50? And don't get me started on over 55. How many women of this ever-advancing age, my ever-advancing age, do you know who are effortlessly lean and impishly lithe? Oh, sure, I'd be thin, too, if I starved myself and spent a tragically huge portion of the day jogging and or hurling myself ever forward, drenched in sweat and downward dogging my sunrise salutations before moving on to Pilates sessions filled with far from free weights. Sure, if I did all that, it would be impossible not to resemble a clothespin with tits. But to be a feast for an army of snacking eyes requires devoting chunks of your time to denying yourself on the one hand and forcing yourself on the other. There's a breed of women in Hollywood who wander among us looking very tense and very mad. Of course they're angry. Who wouldn't be enraged about having to ensure you're looking an age you haven't been in a generation? Regarding the concept of letting yourself go, shouldn't we be able to at some point? Of course, whether or not we should be able is moot. There are two choices past 45. Letting ourselves go, or making ourselves sit like good, well-groomed, obliging pets, coats smooth and wrinkle-free, stomachs flat, muscles taut, teeth clean, hair dyed, nails manicured, everything just so. The thing is, though, not only is this completely unnatural, requiring warehouses full of self-control and perseverance, but it demands a level of discomfort you have to be willing to live with till death by lap band or liposuction. Until then, everyone marvels at how almost completely unengaged you look. It's spooky. You look like a teenager, to the point where I kind of want to ground you. Go to your room. Because I said so, and no dinner. People spend oceans of time ensuring that they are camera ready at all times. They glide through this unofficial American-idolized world, aching to impress the judgmentally ill-making audience that we move among, inspiring them to say, "No, I don't believe it. You can't be. I could have sworn you were sisters. You must tell me your secret, please. I'm begging you." Because given a choice between youth and beauty or age and wisdom, I'll let you guess which one most of us would opt for. Take all the time you need. I'll wait here. Then, just when I'd almost resigned myself to living out my remaining years as Betty the Fat Girl, my unexpected ship came in, the SS Jenny Craig. I mean, is this an amazing planet or what? There I am, ginormously minding my own business, show, monkey, and otherwise, when where should I suddenly find myself but right up there in lights on none other than Jenny Craig's list? That's right. I am getting paid to do something I ought to have done years and years and pounds ago. Now, before you think, why her? Oh, sure. Just because she's a celebrity, she has all the luck, while a regular human like me... Hang on. Before you go any further, don't forget. Not only do I win the wacky Jenny Craig lottery, I'm also a bipolar recovering drug addict who woke up with a dead friend and got left for a man. Those and other such details could be seen from a certain vantage point to kind of balance out the Jenny miracle luck fest. Yeah, I know. If I weren't a celebrity, this wouldn't have happened. But don't think I'm not totally grateful it happened for any reason at all. I wish shit like that could happen to everyone. And not just so you think I'm a nice gal, which I confess is pretty much always in there somewhere. But I guess if it happened to everyone, then winning the lottery would get to be this kind of ho-hum. What a snore. I'm a millionaire again. Of course, the Jenny Craig folks are always on the lookout for giantly fat celebrities to go on their program and prove how easy and effective it is. And humiliated though I was, being the poster girl for humongousness is not something any kid grows up aspiring to. I not only needed to lose the weight so I could rejoin the world, but I also needed the money they'd pay me to do it. Okay, go ahead. Hate me. I can't really blame you. And though that makes me a whore of giant proportions, I also wouldn't be a whore with just any John, or whatever they call them. See, I'm not a good liar. I mean, there's a bunch of other things I could do for money. I could sell ECT machines or mood stabilizers or Star Wars scented laxative. But do I do that? Do I go on TV and sell a medication while running around on some random backyard with some rented golden retriever, laughing and looking cured and amazed to be so worry-free while a voice comes on and says, Reginol is not recommended for fish or Libras with dementia. If you notice swelling in your right butt cheek or notice a subtle beam of backlight glowing northward from your anus or the anus of someone you went to school with, call your doctor immediately as this could be a symptom of hydrocephalus that could lead to teabagging and loneliness. Reginol is not recommended for pregnant Nazis or yodelers over 70. Reginol does not protect you from unpopularity or autism. All I'm ultimately saying is, how great is it that I've been paid handsomely to get healthy and weigh what people have to weigh to be pretty, or pretty thin? In any event, this is a fucking awesome confluence of debt reduction and cutting my swollen self down to social life size. Craig is great. Craig is good. Thank you for this food. Amen. And by men, I mean the four or five that might look at me again in a few genified months. And when I say look, I don't just mean in amazement at my vague resemblance to a space princess from the silent screen era, but because I look good for my age, and maybe even for the age I was a year or two ago. The Senator. What else was I going to tell you? Oh, yeah. about the time I went on a blind date with a senator from Connecticut. No, sorry, it wasn't Joe Lieberman. In 1985, I was filming a TV miniseries, a now almost quaint form of entertainment, currently being single-handedly kept from extinction by HBO, that unspooled its yarn over a contained period of several life-altering nights. This particular miniseries, which set out to tell the story of how the Frenchman Frédéric Bartholdi came to build the Statue of Liberty, answered to the imaginative name of, wait for it, Liberty. It starred, among others, Chris Sarandon, Frank Langella, Dana Delaney, LeVar Burton, Claire Bloom, George Kennedy, and me. I played Emma Lazarus, the gal whose sonnet, The New Colossus, appears on a plaque on Lady Liberty's base. Give me your poor, your tired, your huddled hunchback masses yearning to be free, fun-loving and straight-backed, or, if not actually straight, then gay, as befits an immigrant mincing stylishly through Ellis Island. I may be misremembering some of the words, but hopefully you get the gist. Liberty was shot on location in Baltimore, a semi-stone throw from Washington, D.C. At some point, while the weeks of filming marched majestically monthward, a producer friend of mine from L.A. suggested that I look up Chris Dodd, who, in addition to being his buddy, was also a U.S. senator. At the time, I had become less discriminating than I might have been about the projects I subjected myself, as well as a potentially agonized audience, to. Not quite 30, my filmography included not just Shampoo, Hannah and Her Sisters, and the Star Wars trilogy, but also such seminal classics as Hollywood Vice Squad, I played a policewoman out to take down a child pornographer, and Under the Rainbow, considered to be the Gone with the Wind for the under 4'6" set. One review described it as a what-if comedy that poses the question, what if 150 people auditioning to play the Munchkins in MGM's The Wizard of Oz were staying in the same hotel as some Nazis and a group of spies? If you look it up on the Rotten Tomatoes website, you'll find this prominently displayed excerpt from that review. A peculiar career choice for Fisher. Liberty, though, had some class. I mean, it was written by Pete Hamill, which was nothing to sneeze at, right? And where does this phrase, nothing to sneeze at, come from? And why is it such a negative? I often consider sneezing at things as a tribute of sorts. So, having recently graduated completely healed and normal from my first stint in a rehab, and appearing in an almost perfectly respectable piece of work, I found myself driving from Baltimore to Washington, D.C., to have dinner with Chris Dodd, this senator who I knew virtually nothing about. Nor did Senator Dodd, like most people then and now and always, have any idea who I was in the wide, wide world beyond this cute little actress who'd played Princess Leia. And what did it matter? That is who I was. Maybe not to myself, but then I won't be consulted on that future day when my death is reported, and a picture of Princess Leia will appear on television with two dates under my absurdly bewigged face. The senator was not a handsome man, but he was far from ugly. Probably in his early 50s, he had, as I recall, the reddest of cheeks, the whitest of hair, and the bluest of eyes. An American face. And there was a merry sort of force that twinkled out of these eyes. merry, alert, and intensely engaged in making the most of this world for himself and even others, be they his Connecticut constituents or girls from the West, newly sober and inclined to adventures outside the norm, whatever that might be. So there I was, being driven around the iconic sites of our capital by an actual bona fide senator. And what I was noticing was that Senator Dodd's skin began pale and smooth at his brow and flowed serenely past his cheekbones, with his chin continuing unhindered by jawline, through to his neck and beyond, smoothly to the rest of him. But while he may not have been a gorgeous man, this was a powerful man, a man used to getting and making his own way. And powerful men of any sort don't have to be movie star handsome, as long as they remain powerful. And it was clear that Chris Todd was in it for the long run. I sat beside him in his unassuming car, enjoying the ride as the senator drove me around the Capitol, proudly providing me with a brief history of each formidable sight we passed in the gathering twilight. We took in the Supreme Court, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial, and even the U.S. Mint. So much to see, so much to learn, especially if you didn't know all that much to begin with. Now, I freely admit to having rather large gaps in various areas of knowledge. Hopefully less now than then, but most of my life I found myself tumbling over one area or another along the way that I felt I perhaps should, but didn't, know about. And at this point in my life, government was one of them. And, as you will now see, it was a decidedly cavernous gap. As we made our way from our tour of the monuments to our assignation at a nearby Georgetown restaurant, I turned to the senator, who I was now being encouraged to address as Chris, rather than, say, Ballsack or Fucktard, and said, "So, Chris, I was wondering, how many senators are there, actually?" It was probably only his intention to sleep with me that kept him from laughing mercilessly. When I phoned my mother later that night and told her what I'd asked him, she was appropriately horrified. "Oh, dear, how could you? Everyone knows there's one per state." Anyway, having been reacquainted with what it meant to be a free American by a genuine hoping to get reelected and, in the shorter term, laid senator, it was time to meet our fellow dinner companions. Two other couples, half of one of which was also a senator. And not just any old senator, but one considered by many, and certainly by those who had no idea how many senators there even were, to be the senator. Yes, that's right. Ted Kennedy. Also with us, and by us, I mean them, was Ted's girlfriend of the moment, a very pretty blonde girl, appropriately demure and or well-bred, named Lacey Newhouse. I don't remember Senator, call me Chris Dodds, having alerted me to the impressive identity of our pending dinner companion, but I have to assume that he did, as he had only just met me, and so couldn't be sure that I wouldn't be struck dumb as a fairly smart person can be struck, by the close proximity of someone of Senator Kennedy's mien. Completing the round six-seat table nestled in a dimly lit private room on the second floor of this very exclusive restaurant in the virulently charming neighborhood of Georgetown was a lovely married couple about whom all I knew at the time was that they lived next door to Ethel Kennedy's Hickory Hill estate. Given the exclusive area of town they called home, and given the ease with which they conducted themselves in the current American Royal Company, I had to assume they were extremely wealthy, intelligent, and well-connected people. I do recall that they were also charming, and not just because they appeared to find me so. Their names have escaped the often unlocked cage of my memory. Though the lines between show business celebrity and political prominence have frequently blurred, the chasm between the skill set required to distinguish oneself in Hollywood as opposed to Washington is fairly vast. Despite this, all too often the two disparate worlds of the well-known not only overlap, but have been known to actually fuse, resulting in hybrids that have provided us with mutations along the lines of President Reagan and Governor Schwarzenegger. This mutual attraction between our political leaders and our entertainers has led to numerous instances of what might be described as crossbreeding. President Kennedy's White House dalliances with Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor's marriage to Virginia Senator John Warner, Jane Fonda's marriage to Tom Hayden, Deborah Winger's relationship with Nebraska Governor Bob Kerrey, Linda Ronstadt's seeing, and presumably hearing and speaking to, and even feeling, California Governor Jerry Brown. And now it was my turn to contribute to this overlap, however briefly and insignificantly. Chris and Senator Kennedy, I quickly learned, could be snatched from us at any moment, summoned back to the Senate floor for a vote. So we were united in this limbo between food and drink and the potential pressing call to attend to the running of our country. I was impressed. So, with the shadow of the floor looming over our little gathering, the two senators held 4th, 5th, 6th, and beyond while sipping red wine and consuming appetizers. Senator Kennedy was particularly eloquent. I don't recall his subject matter, but I do remember it was of a topical political nature. Shocking, I know. It occurs to me that Nicaragua had something to do with it. That was the country Americans argued about at the time, but I can't be certain of pretty much anything lately when it comes to memory, but there's the swap. Out goes the depression propelled by friendly electricity, and with it go all manner of recollections that at one time might have stayed put. But I do remember marveling at him, if that's an appropriate expression. What I'm trying to say is, this was surely a remarkable human. I mean, you don't get to his position in the world by accident or without merit. At least this is what I believe before the arrival on the scene of alarming creatures such as George W. Bush. Well-spoken, extraordinarily intelligent, poised, thought-provoking, he was a statesman in every sense of the word. I was intimidated by him, in awe of him, overwhelmed. He had something, for want of a better word, heroic about him. Not that Chris Dodd lacked these qualities. On the contrary, you could see why they were such good friends. In effect, these men were as close as you might get to royalty in America. And there I was, a few cards short of a royal flush, as the senators held forth on all manner of important issues of national and international consequence, dominating the table. The rest of us were witnesses to these compatible political gladiators. But as the meal wore on, the dynamic began slowly shifting. Not dramatically, just ever so slightly. Having recently entered the wide world of recovery, I was in a feisty sort of mood. I used to call my drug-taking putting the monster in the box. It would reduce the spectacle of my personality to something a little more socially appropriate. But now that drugs were out, so was the monster. It's not as if I didn't know my place or thereabouts, but just because I knew it didn't mean that I could be counted on to stay in it. I meant to be this respectful, newly sober girl in her late 20s, but sadly, these intentions weren't meant to be realized. This night, while I wasn't looking, my cute little monster tiptoed out of her box and waited to see who would have the nuts, or be nuts enough, to take her on. Wine continued to be served. I drank Coca-Cola, and meals were ordered. I sat quietly and listened, hoping perhaps to learn something, but more importantly, to remain as charmingly unobtrusive as possible. Knowing very little of current and not-so-current events, so how many senators are there, actually? I wasn't eager to further embarrass myself. I remember Kennedy's date being rather quiet as well. Along with Ethel Kennedy's charming neighbors, we were kind of innocent bystanders to this happy accident. Then suddenly, their pagers went off. A series of beeps was followed by a cryptic exchange, which was most likely a secretary, as they were still referred to in those days, informing them that they would not be returning to the floor that evening. "All right, then. Relax and let fly." And fly they did. The red wine was replaced by vodka tonics. They went from the grape to hard liquor, the type that softens any sharp edges that might still be standing guard. Now that they were officially off duty, they let their elder statesman graying hair down. As I said, at the start of the evening, I had been in awe of them. Who was I to contribute to a conversation being conducted by such lofty, learned men? Men who ran things. Men who talked the talk. Men who not only knew the law, but wrote it. Surely I was as out of my depth as I ever would be. It wasn't even my depth. It was theirs. I was sinking to the bottom of this erudite senatorial swamp as they rose higher and higher with each cocktail. These were important men who could argue with the president if they wanted. And who was I but some dumb girl who had never graduated from high school? Not only that, but an actress currently filming some movie. Not even a real movie, a TV movie. Something that would eventually fade into that void where all the streams of images eventually flow, a stagnant pool of all unremarkable entertainment. Oh, sure, I'd been in plenty of movies, but the films were important, not me. Even with Star Wars, the character I played was famous. We just happened to have similar faces. Still, I wasn't 30 yet, and I'd had quite a colorful life, if viewed from a generous, all-American slant. But perhaps it was best to keep my mouth shut, lest my lack of education and breeding blow my cover. There was also the business of my sobriety. Having abused my access to the altered state, I was consigned to sip my Coke and watch these amazingly educated and entitled men, now temporarily relieved of their senatorial responsibilities, indulge in Washington's brand of hardcore happy hour. And who could blame them? Who could blame anyone who'd put in a hard day's work keeping our nation's government working? It was only natural to want to take leave of at least some of your senses, and these men had so much sense to start with. Surely they could easily afford to take leave of an ample store of it without causing too much notice. So, in the darkened private dining room, we all sat around our white-clothed, silver-set table and listened as these once noble voices, now laughed and accompanied by a soundtrack of clinking and swirling ice, devolved into bawdier tones. Suddenly, Senator Kennedy, seated directly across from me, looked at me with his alert, aristocratic eyes and asked me the most surprising question. "So," he said, clearly amused, "do you think you'll be having sex with Chris at the end of your date?" Wow. How did we get here from, well, essentially anywhere? What had I done to provoke his eloquent scorn? To my left, Chris Dodd looked at me with an unusual grin hanging on his very flushed face. To my right, the really nice couple said nothing, trying to pretend they hadn't heard what we all so clearly did hear. Senator Kennedy's blonde girlfriend, sitting to his right, non-reacted similarly. What was he doing? Why did he ask me that? Could it be that he meant to cause me an untold amount of embarrassment? What other explanation was there? Why ask someone a shocking, taunting question like that, unless it was your intent to make that someone look and feel like a fool? No, this would not do. Seriously. There was no other way to look at this than completely not okay. Even if this man's brother had been a hero, even if two of his brothers had been heroes, even if he, in his legislation-passing way, was a hero, I was not just going to lie down and let this man walk over me. Funnily enough, I won't be having sex with Chris tonight, I said, my face composed and calm. No, that probably won't happen. People blinked. Thanks for asking, though. A fork clinked on a plate. Why not? The senator demanded of me. Are you too good for him? I tilted my head, my mouth pursed, and glanced at Senator Dodd's expectant face. Not too good, no, just... I shrugged. I'm newly sober, you see, and I'd have to be truly loaded to just fall into bed with someone I've only very recently met, even if that someone is a Democrat. Now the air around us hung back, holding itself in check to see what would happen next. But I knew that I would not let this man get the upper hand, or somehow discomfort or shock me. I had some laws, and this was one. Whatever this imperious, I want to say drunk, but he wasn't that, not yet. Whatever this imperious drunk-to-be threw at me, I'd say something right back. So you were a drinker, he said. What did you drink? I uncrossed and recrossed my legs. A waiter hovered with a bottle. I didn't drink, really, so much as take pills alcoholically. And do acid. I liked acid a lot. I smiled at him without my eyes, watching my unexpected antagonist seated opposite me. Four sets of liberal eyes now slid from my face back to his. There was a smell of bread and chicken. Did you have sex on acid? Wow! This was serious. There was no turning back. I looked to the ceiling for help and found it. Acid isn't that great for sex, you know. Well, maybe you don't. I tilted my head, schooling him socially. Game on. It intensifies everything. It complicates the simplest things and simplifies the most complex. Now the senator was watching me with mild eyes set back in his famous handsome face. all the others were watching us, riveted. I was hyper-alert now, ready for anything. What about masturbation? My eyebrows raised as my hand, almost unconsciously, closed around the butter knife. What about it? He was about to answer when I continued on, unabashed. Oh, do you mean do I do it? On LSD? I squinted my eyes and peered into one of the corners of the room. It occurred to me that this was funny. Funny with an emergency in it. I smiled without losing much of my footing. Play with yourself is the term that I like best. I spread my smile around the table, lickety-split. You know, like playing with a child. I looked down into my unnapkined lap and covered my eyes with both hands, then uncovered them a moment later. Peekaboo! I see you! I cooed down to my crotch. Peekaboo! You're it! Bang, bang, fall down! I made a gun with my thumb and forefinger and shot at my hidden privates. I felt five pairs of very astonished round eyes staring at me from all around the table. This was a circle of privileged people gathered together to enjoy their privileges, and although, as I said, in our country there's no actual royalty, no generations of fragile, fine folk sitting on thrones and wearing shiny crowns, if there is anything like American aristocracy, then it's them, the Kennedys. They've always seemed to me to be in a class all by themselves. As a priest with a thick Irish brogue once told me, no one understands what this family goes through. I think of them as the special Ks. And then there's what I've heard called real royalty, the scandal-laden kings and queens of the silver screen. It's from this seed that I sprouted. This is the heredity that claims me, informs me, defines me. This is part of what had led me, and not blindfolded, to this room in this restaurant where I was on a blind date with a senator. A senator who laughed at my pantomime of playing peekaboo with my privates in an effort to entertain, yes, partly, but mainly to place myself outside the grasp of Senator Kennedy's withering sarcasm. Did he take me on like that because I was merely an actress by profession, a job requiring little or no intellect or education? Did he turn his blazing, bright scorn on me because I looked like a willing victim? Maybe. I guess I'll never know, as he is now gone from us. A great man, making those who dined with him on this night near great. But I was just a cute little thing, barely big enough to be worth tearing down with gentle teasing, let alone this full-on assault. By now we had blundered headlong into a world of who could outshock who. Which one of us would say the thing that would stun the table into silence? Not that most of those assembled weren't silent already, having stepped back without moving to get out of the way of the rude business at hand. Somehow the subject of my father came up. My father? I didn't see my father that much when I was growing up. He left when I was small, you see. Kennedy must have asked more about my father, somehow daring or double daring me to go further than someone would normally go. Socially, I mean. At a table with two senators who until this night had been strangers to me, and those other three humans in attendance. All of us waiting to see what would happen. Just how far would we each go? Would I take the bait and reply to each all-too-intimate question? When would one of us, or the evening itself, hit the proverbial wall? The night before I got married, I was talking to my father on the phone from my future husband and future ex-husband's house. And my father said to me, "You have a great ass. You should be marrying me." And you know what I said? I fixed my brown eyes on Senator Kennedy's blue ones. "What?" he obligingly asked me. I said, after thinking about it for a second, as one would, I said, "Thank you." These sorts of stories beg for a pause while everyone tries to sort out what was just said, blinking with thoughts forming behind our eyes. "Do you think he actually meant that?" he asked. "No," I said. "I think he was just high and saying those things for conversation's sake." I don't believe we could have gotten to this place if I hadn't thought, "Oh, you think you can embarrass me? You think you can ask me something shocking? And what, I'll sit here, flipped to the tits, tongue-tied and rendered speechless from the shock and awe of it?" The senator and I stared at each other from across the table. Whose move was it? Surely not mine. "What do you do with your father that you like to do?" he asked finally, to which I responded, "Sing." He tilted his head and rubbed his chin, while his other hand raised yet another drink to his mouth. "Sing, then," he ordered me mildly. "Sing what you would sing with your dad." It was a dare. I swear it was. I have a clear image in my mind of sitting quite tall, or as tall as one can sit and still be quite short. I sat and opened my mouth, and out came my voice, clear and bold and loud, singing a signature tune from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel. I began, "And I do have a good voice, I swear. I'd have to with both parents being singers." Everything was quiet but for my singing. And the whole time my eyes held his, and his held mine right back. The others at the table were stunned witnesses. Years later, I was in Washington at a party celebrating Clinton's second inauguration, and a woman rushed up to me with her face shining and said, "Do you remember me? I was there that night in the restaurant with Ted Kennedy and Chris Dodd." I blinked at her. "Sure, I remember," I said. "Who could forget a night like that?" We were on a staircase, and she was holding both of my arms, breathless and beaming. We spoke of that night for ages. It was incredible. We'd waited for years for someone to take him on like that. So it did happen. I didn't make it up, didn't hallucinate it, didn't forge it out of some gray, lying part of my brain where dreams go to die. There really was a night that I sat and sang at this famous senator from New England. Sang the entire song without once breaking free from the cage of his gaze. And these neighbors of his sister-in-law, Ethel, they proved it. See? We were all really there. Back at the table in 1985, Senator Dodd beamed at me on my left as I sang. "Why haven't I met you before?" he asked me later in the car. And much later still, the good senator ran for president. And while he was running, he at some point declared, that we had dated long ago. Probably a bid for the Comic-Con vote. A courtship, he explained, when asked the nature of our relations all those decades past. It was a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, he added. Oh, no, I thought when I heard about it. You didn't. You couldn't possibly have said something so lame. But he did. At least it was reported that he did. And hearing it, I cringed. A courtship? Is that what they call sleeping together a few times? A courtship? Or a spaceship? Not a relationship, that's for sure. I came to the end of the song I sang with my dear old dad, and now to Senator Kennedy, God rest both of their troubled souls. The notes hung in the air between the six of us seated round that table in Georgetown a quarter century ago. The bill was paid, the evening was at an end. We began walking down the stairs toward the futures that lay beyond the dark that awaited us outside. "Would you have sex with Chris in a hot tub?" Senator Kennedy asked me, perhaps as a way to say goodnight. "I'm no good in water," I told him. And that's where the memory ends. The Princess and the King. I did not know Michael Jackson that well, at least not in the sense that I think of as knowing someone. But in the climate that developed in the wake of his death, to not have known him well was, for some, enough to be seen as having known him intimately. And from this certain skewed slant, I could even be perceived as one of Michael's closest friends. He and I had just two people in common. Michael was very close pals with a former stepmother of mine, Elizabeth Taylor, and we had the same dermatologist. I would say we shared the same dermatologist, but that sounds so unsanitary, especially when that dermatologist is Arnold Klein, the original font from which all collagen and Botox could flow. The thing is, I do know Arnie Klein well, and Arnie, the dermatologist to the stars, was fastened at his rather ample hip to Michael's very skinny one. You see, they each had something that the other desperately coveted. Arnie wanted to be friends with not just an otherwise inaccessible celebrity, but the biggest star on the planet for him and his friends to cavort with. "Ben, this is my friend Michael. Michael, this is my friend Ben, the guy I told you about." And Michael wanted access to the farthest reaches of the medical community 24/7, at a speed and with an ease that would ordinarily be unavailable to almost anyone at all at any level. Therein lay the swap. I'm not saying that this was the sole reason for their friendship, far from it. Michael trusted Arnie. He trusted him enough to choose one of his nurses to have children for him. Yes, I know, a very strange, unusual way to demonstrate trust, but there you have it. Hollywood is an unusual place, and where celebrity is a factor, things become less predictable. The moment that I actually met Michael is vague in my memory, as is, have I mentioned it, quite a bit these days. You would think that meeting someone as unique as Michael would somehow stay in my mind, but unique was not extraordinary to me. I'd become, if not immune to its charms, then certainly far from thrilled. To be sure, Michael was very unusual. For one thing, his relationship to his appearance was, let's be kind and call it atypical. That he could have consistently hammered away at his perfectly nice original face until he arrived at that strange place he paused at. That he was able to look in the mirror and essentially say, yes, this is a face I'm more comfortable with presenting the world than the one that I was born with. Well, the word dysmorphic doesn't approach it, let alone cover it. Michael was, to say the least, out of the ordinary. Miles out. Somewhere that leaves ordinary far behind. But to be such a distance from ordinary obviously makes you a singular sort of person. And Michael certainly was that. Peerless, unlike any other, uncommon. Michael was so distinctively other. He possessed qualities that very few others could lay claim to. Some qualities that few would wish for, but others that to some would seem blessed. He could move, and move others, like no other. He altered any room he was in, which could not only make someone want to be in those rooms, but also want to stay out. One weekend, Billy and I were invited to Neverland, Michael's ranch somewhere north of L.A. We weren't invited by Michael, but by Arnie. Michael had loaned Arnie his house for the weekend so he could have people up there to celebrate his birthday. So it was Billy and myself and one of her 5-year-old friends from school, and Arnie and his lover Ben, plus an assortment of Arnie's overweight gay male buddies, called bears by the community, as it were. Arnie is a big man himself, and he likes to surround himself with other similarly fleshy bears of a feather. So we gathered in Michael's vast manicure acreage, on which was ensconced a neat cluster of guest houses, complete with their own little Neverland bars of soap, which naturally I stole and then promptly lost. How often I thought of that soap. How I could have showed it off to friends and maybe even have made a little Michael Jackson soap altar with a little spotlight shining on it in a kind of solemn circle, causing the white of the soap to alternately shine and glow. Who else could have the whole Disneyland train thing at the entrance of his humble home? Not to mention the rides and the projection room with the candy shop and the pizza parlor. Can you even conceive of being able to have all these things? How much does constructing an empire like that widen the gap between you and everyone else? How many other private zoo and amusement park owners can you commiserate with about what it's like when the roller coaster breaks down? What a hassle, right? Who do you use for that? 'Cause I can't find anyone. And how's your gorilla doing? Did you take him to that groomer I recommended? It's really hard to find a good gorilla groomer nowadays, you know. Did you find a new pilot for your G5? I'll have my assistant call yours with the name of this great guy who flew Geffen's jet for a while. And on, placing yourself beyond the reach of ordinary discourse. Of course, you don't have to only talk to people in your tax bracket. You can be with people with far less income, but you might find yourself apologizing for the disparity, you know? I know. Boo-hoo-hoo, right? You have so much money that your social options become more limited. Anyway, Michael's social options were severely restricted. At least that's how it seemed to me. He kind of stood apart from everything and everyone, pulling whatever focus was available and waiting to see what would happen, who would come, and how it would be. The exceptions were his children. He made himself a trio of companions to share his unique space, so distant from the ordinarily inhabited realms. Michael and I both had childhoods that were, by most ordinary standards, decidedly unusual. How many children start performing at such a young age? He was 6, I a relatively more reasonable 13. How many children perform for real audiences to begin with? For that matter, how many people of any age ever perform for real audiences? Michael was famous long before he could even dimly understand what being adult meant. He was someone to other people well before he knew who he was to himself. At least I had arrived at that complex stage referred to as puberty, outside the complex glare of a spotlight. But Michael, well, Michael was a child doing an adult's job, a job that set him apart from everyone else his age, or everyone else, period. Who were his peers? Who could he relate to? Who would not have to pretend not to be weirded out by his radioactive celebrity? You know the term starstruck? It's an odd term, isn't it? And of course it can only happen to people who aren't stars. The starstruck are thrown off, impacted by celebrity in a way that they find difficult to recover from, at least in the immediate time frame. I think that maybe one of the reasons that Michael could trust me, to the degree that he was able to trust anyone, is that I was immune to celebrity's charm. Repeated exposure to anything renders it increasingly ordinary. The same especially holds true for what might otherwise, or initially, be considered extraordinary. Sort of like too much of a good thing. The charm wears off, the bloom shakes off the rose, and it's midnight at Cinderella's ball. I never went into show business. It surrounded me from my first breath. A neater trick would have been to sneak out. I'd never wanted to be an actress, let alone a celebrity. I'd grown up watching the bright glow of my parents' stardom slowly dim, cool, and fade. I watched both my parents scramble to stay in the light. But fame has an unpredictable half-life. While it's not necessarily fleeting, it is guaranteed to inevitably flee, running and screaming from the room. When I got the part of a princess in this goofy little science fiction film, I thought, what the fuck, right? It'll be fun to do. I'm 19. Who doesn't want to have fun at 19? I'll go hang out with a bunch of robots for a few months, and then I'll go back to my real life and try to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. Who knows? Maybe I'll go to college, you know? Real college, not a pretend drama one. Or I could get a Eurail pass and blunder around Europe with the rest of the hippie students. But then, this goofy little 3-month hangout with robots did something unexpected. It misbehaved. It did something no movie had ever really done before. It exploded across the firmament of pop culture, taking all of us along with it. It tricked me into becoming a star, all on my who-gives-a-shit own. I don't mean to sound ungrateful, because sure, there are plenty of things about being a celebrity that are fun, right? Things like traveling, getting a good table at a full restaurant, and generally being treated better than almost any human could possibly deserve. But from the very beginning, I knew something that wouldn't ordinarily have crossed another brand new celebrity's mind. I knew it would be over eventually, that I was on the clock in a way that the other newly famous folks had no idea about. Oh, admit it, I can hear you crying for me for my high-class problem of the nosebleed variety. Still, my knowing this put a kind of damper on the whole thing. I don't actually know what a damper is, but whatever it is, it doesn't sound good. I was playing a waiting game. My coach would turn into a pumpkin, the footmen would go back to being the rodents they once were. So, rather than wait for this shoe to drop, for this glass slipper to shatter, I thought, why not break it myself and get it over with? Break it and go back to that place where I had only a normal amount to lose. What does all of this have to do with Michael Jackson? Frankly, I can't quite remember how I got out here on this limb of what's so bad about looking good. But I do know that if there's any kind of a vibe that I emanate, it's that I don't give a shit about celebrity. Actually, that's not quite accurate. It's not that I don't care about it. It's that I don't trust it. It shaped my entire life. And maybe not even...